This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Constantine von Hofmeister. Constantine, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, hello, how are you? Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter and Rabbit. And
hey,
Rabbit, you published Constantine's Futurist Manifesto on a blog you run, National Futurism.
Yeah, I did. In fact, there's probably still more out there I could find of his and add to it, but I got it started a couple years ago.
Constantine, you describe yourself as a national futurist.
Yeah, that's correct.
There's a perception that nationalists are traditionalist or reactionaries. Can you explain why you describe yourself as a futurist and reject extreme reactionary and traditionalist views?
Well, I would describe myself as a futurist, but not as a nationalist, and I chose the name National Futurism because I wanted a right-wing version of futurism. I wanted to emphasize that it's a right-wing version of futurism, and I only used the prefix national to emphasize this fact, but actually I would say that I'm opposed to nationalism, because, especially nationalism in Europe, because it always creates strife between different European nations, and I advocate, say, the Imperium Europa, like the idea of a greater Europe, an empire, so to speak, on the imperial model, and not nation states or a federation of nation states. So, and futurism, I chose, I would call myself a futurist because, well, it's because it's the Faustian nature of Western man, of the white man, because the white man always tries to move further, to move upwards, basically to conquer space and to ever advance, basically. So it exemplifies the Faustian or the Promethean nature of, I would say, the white man. Yeah, and this is the main reason why I would call myself a futurist, because I advocate this Faustian impulse, because this Faustian impulse has propelled the white race to where it is now. And if we're lucky, it might propel us even further.
Can you explain why you wrote your Futurist Manifesto? I think this was a while back, like in 2010, and what were the key points you made in that manifesto?
Yeah, I think it's even... I don't exactly remember when I wrote it. I think, yeah, it must have been like 2009, 2010, yeah.
And, it was actually back in like from 2004 to 2006.
Right.
It actually goes way back.
Right, yeah. So it's about... Yeah, I would say like it was like 14 years ago, 13, 14 years ago. I don't know. I was reading a lot of like of the Italian futurists at the time. I felt inspired, so to speak. And to be honest, I was interested in the Italian futurists and the Dadaists, the Dada movement at the same time. So I was reading a lot of literature about these two movements. And I felt inspired. And my original idea was sort of like a joke to create the movement called National Dadaism, which would have been a contradiction in terms, but at the time I thought, yeah, would have been sort of funny, you know, because Dadaism was opposed to this bourgeois concept of nationalism, and to have like two extremes, like nationalism, Dadaism in one thing, and call it National Dadaism, I thought it was a joke, but then I changed it, and instead I created National Futurism. And like I said, basically, it's like modeled on like Marinetti and the Italian futurists, who were themselves, I would say, nationalists or even imperialists in terms of wanting to recreate the glory of Rome, but in a futurist setting. And I just basically wanted an updated version of this for the 21st century.
That's funny because I've been flirting with terms, too. I've made up this thing called Asian Aryanism where... You know, the word Aryanism is kind of like you think of this Nazi with blonde hair and blue eyes and this mega soldier, right? And then it's like Asian. Wait, Asian Aryan, that's not possible. What are you doing? And it seems like with National Dadaism, I kind of like that terminology too, where it's like – It's kind of like the thing like national Bolshevism, where it's like they look like Bolsheviks, or no, they look like Nazis, but they're supposed to be Bolsheviks, but they have the mentality of like a red, white, black Nazi thing. So it's an interesting thing when you play with these terms. People might find them as oxymorons, but when given the chance to slowly speak in what you're trying to say, it's not that bad at all, or that you have a very specific meaning on certain policies and whatnot. And it's very interesting. Different ideologies can go certain ways.
Well, with national Bolshevism, it's quite interesting because I live in Moscow and I've been in Moscow off and on like for the last 12 years. And I met a lot of like Russian national Bolsheviks. I would say it was about, it was 2005, also 2005, 2006, when I was hanging out with a lot of national Bolsheviks, Russian ones here in Moscow. And, well, apparently there are two factions of national Bolsheviks. In Russia, they're the Duginists, the people that follow the Alexander Dugin and the Eurasianists.
I've interviewed him. He's much more of a radical traditionalist than you are.
He is, yeah. Well, I know. Well, I've met him several times. And when I first came to Moscow in 2005, there was the founding conference of the Eurasian Youth Movement, which is like the organization that Dugin founded back then. And he invited me as a speaker, and I gave a speech at this conference in 2005. And the conference was held in the town of Alexandrov, which is, I'm not sure, like 100 or maybe 150 kilometers away from Moscow. And the conference was held in the Kremlin of this town, and it's historically significant because Ivan Grozny, also known as Ivan the Terrible, lived there for a time. So the founding conference of this organization that Dugin founded was held in the throne room where Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible, used to sit. And yeah, I remember I gave a speech about, I think it was about Russian-German friendship and how important it is, because like according to Bismarck back then, like it's... if Russia and Germany worked together, they would be unstoppable in Europe, basically. And the United States has been trying, I would say, ever since World War I or even earlier, to keep these two nations apart and basically create hostilities between Russia and Germany so they can't find a rapprochement. I think that was the idea of my speech. But just to go back real quick, because Alexander Dugin's idea of national Bolshevism is closely tied up with his philosophy of Eurasianism, which I would describe as more like third worldism, because he's not really interested in, I say, the white race in Europe. He's more interested in creating this, I would say, like this Eurasian empire, which includes, I would say, certain European nations, but also certain Asian nations.
Also interested in sort of Evola's idea of a spiritual race as opposed to a material race.
Yeah, I'm completely opposed to Evola's concept, because in my opinion, Evola is not a role model for people that are very serious about preserving the white race. Because if you want to save the white race, you need to, in my opinion, you need to adopt an imperialist and strict materialist outlook, because materialism dictates that spirituality stems from matter. And Ebola's notion of a spiritual race is a contradiction in terms, because race is matter and not spirit. And according to Ebola, like non-Europeans can possess Aryan attributes and are therefore sort of like honorary Aryans, which is for me quite strange, because okay, they have Aryan attributes, they might be called honorary Aryans, but they can't pass on these attributes because it would dilute the European gene pool. So in my opinion, Ebola is more like a racial universalist, because he doesn't really, he's not really interested in the purely biological concept of race, or in the preservation of the actual race, the biological race.
Can you explain more about your concept of a Euro-Siberia, a super state from the Atlantic to Siberia? Because, as opposed to independent nations, because a lot of people will say that that's basically what the European Union is, and the EU hasn't really turned out that well.
Well, it's not my concept. It was Guillaume Fay, the French philosopher, who came up with a concept and the name Euro-Siberia. I just like it a lot, so I founded a Facebook group, Euro-Siberia, to discuss this project that Guillaume Fay has in mind. And also there were two conferences in 2005 and one in 2006, both in Moscow. It's called the Euro-Russia conference. And the term Euro-Russia is basically synonymous with Euro-Siberia, except that some like Russian, I would say, racialists prefer the term Euro-Russia to Euro-Siberia, because they say, Euro-Siberia means nothing. What does it mean? Europe and Siberia. But in reality, it's Europe and Russia together. I feel the exact opposite, because I feel that the term Euro-Russia is misleading, because it implies that Russia is not an integral part of Europe, and I believe Russia is an integral part of Europe and should not be separated in a term like Euro-Russia. That's why I prefer Guillaume Faye's original term, Euro-Siberia. And so in 2005, Guillaume Faye was in Moscow, and I also met him here in Moscow. We had lots of discussions, and he gave a speech about this concept of Euro-Siberia. And, well, basically, it is like the European Union. It's it's an imperial structure, which, according to Faye, should be like from Dublin to Vladivostok, like an empire, Imperium Europa, so to speak. The difference is that it's a pro-European union. And the EU, as it exists today, is an anti-European union, because it seeks the destruction of the white race by importing millions of immigrants and enacting laws and legislation that only hurt the native population of Europe. While Guillaume Faye says, like the structure itself of the European Union, as it exists, is not necessarily negative and can be taken over. We just need to enact pro-white laws within the already existing structure of the EU, and at the same time enlarge it by somehow finding a rapprochement with Russia, and therefore unite the Western white race with Eastern white race.
Do you favor distinct European identities, or kind of a fusionism similar to what we have in America, a lot of white Americans, including myself, are a mixture of a lot of different European ethnicities and culture. Do you advocate that? And what do you think about people who say that would lead to America ending up like Europe ending up like America, where people sort of lack those distinct cultural identities?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm rather indifferent, because I believe in freedom of association, and if you have like sort of like a European Union or Euro-Siberia, European superstructure without actual nation states and without borders between the nation states, I mean, you would have freedom of movement, so it would be unavoidable that there would be some kind of intermixing going on between different European ethnicities. Like, I wouldn't promote it, but I wouldn't prohibit it either, so I would just see what happens. Because in my opinion, like, it would happen, but it wouldn't happen on a massive scale, because I think most people would still stay, I don't know, among their own ethnicities or their own within their own nations. So, well, we'll just see what happens, I guess.
Do you view America and the American system of neoliberal globalism or Islam as the greatest threat to Europe, or both as threats?
Yeah, like, I would differentiate the two. I would say, like, Islam is an actual enemy of Europe, but America is merely a competitor of Europe, because even today, the white people make up the majority population of the United States. Therefore, they can never be an enemy, because they're the same people, because they're brothers and sisters of Europeans, because they essentially are Europeans. While Islam is an alien religion, and also mostly composed of an alien race that practices this religion, and they are bent on conquest, and they show it in Europe. They want to impose Sharia law and their own values, their own ideals, on the European population. And I would say they're quite successful in doing so, because the Europeans are not fighting back, either because they have corrupt governments, or they're too brainwashed to do anything about it. Because sometimes I wonder, because you have a lot of Europeans have the chance to vote for the right parties, but they don't. But then you hear like statistics that, I don't know, 60% of Europeans are against Muslim immigration. But at the same time, parties like the AfD in Germany only get like 13%. So I don't know, it doesn't jive. It doesn't match somehow. But yeah, I would say Islam is the enemy. America is merely a competitor, and well, we have to see what happens in America, like which road America is going to go down. Well, now you have a very positive development, I think, with Donald Trump as president, and if he continues the path that he started heading down, then I think he, and if, say, Le Pen wins in France, I think it will create a political earthquake in Europe. And then Trump, Le Pen could work together, maybe in conjunction with Viktor Orban in Hungary. So, yeah, something really positive could come out of this, where Americans and Europeans could finally again find back to each other and work against common threats, as opposed to working against each other.
I mean, you're originally from Germany. How bad is the whole migrant crisis there? What do you see as the future with Islam in Europe, especially Germany? And do you think Germany has a future?
To be honest, if I want to be brutally realistic, I see no future for Germany. Just because of pure demographics. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but I go to Germany quite often, maybe once, twice, sometimes three times a year with my family to visit relatives. And I know we hang out, we travel a lot inside Germany. And you see, quote-unquote, refugees or foreigners from non-European countries virtually everywhere in Germany now. So it's not just the big cities, it's the small towns, even villages. And last time I was in Germany, I went with my family, with my wife and my children, to a public swimming pool, sort of like a water park with slides and everything. It was during the day and it was during the week, but it was already full of the refugees, I suppose, because they don't work. They have nothing to do, so they hang out in the water park and, yeah, all wearing their burkinis and having children with regular diapers, not those like swim diapers, but regular diapers, probably full of poop, but they're not bothered by it because apparently in their culture it's normal, and basically harassing people on the slides, very boisterous, loud, aggressive young men. And the Germans feel intimidated, and you can tell they're intimidated by this. And you have signs in Arabic in a swimming pool, I suppose, like to tell these foreigners how to behave, but I don't think they bother to read these rules. And you can walk around at night in big German cities. You have gangs of these people. And I was strolling down the street very aggressively. The Germans feel afraid, naturally, because they've been brainwashed by the media, the government, and the education system that they should always be welcome to the foreigners and should not show any hostility towards them. And Merkel has already invited, I don't know, 1 million, 1.5 million, possibly 2 million over the last 2 years. And none of them are going to leave, or very, very few of these are going to leave. Most of them will stay in Germany forever. And a lot of them will bring their family, because it was mostly young men that came, so a lot of them will now bring their wives and 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 children. So instead of 2 million, we'll have 5 million, 6 million, 7 million. They'll procreate, and the German government is now talking that, yeah, because of the demographic crisis, because Germans are not having enough children, it's probably necessary to permanently invite 300,000 foreigners per year to Germany, just so that Germany has a future, economically speaking. So with all this in mind, I see no future for Germany, because the Germans are dying out, because they're not really having any children, and they're inviting foreigners to replace them, and they want to do this on a permanent basis. So I don't know what's going to happen to Germany if nothing drastically happens to halt and reverse this process very soon. Germany's finished, I think.
Could you see ethnic Germans fleeing Germany to neighboring countries like Denmark, the Czech Republic, or even the United States?
Yeah, good. I think it's happening already. It's already happening to some extent, but just very, very few Germans are like running away that I've read about and that I've heard about in the German media. Like a couple of Germans are going to Hungary because they're like the nationalist and the conservative government there. A few went to Russia that I've read about. America, I'm not so sure. I haven't heard about it. But I think it's mostly Russia, Hungary, maybe Poland, and, yeah, maybe the Czech Republic and other Central or Eastern European nations that the Germans, the ones that are leaving, that the ones that are pissed off with the situation, are emigrating to. But it's not on a massive scale. It's just like just a few disgruntled Germans. It might grow. Like there might be an exodus if it continues like this, because more and more Germans are very upset about the situation in Germany. So I don't know. I can see it happening in the future. More and more Germans moving away.
I've heard before that a lot of actually the resistance to the migrants in Germany, it's all basically in what was East Germany. Now that's where apparently all of the actual, you know, resistance to these this immigration is. And can you speak a little bit about that? Like, why is it that the East Germany in particular resists this, and as well as you see it in the former communist, former Soviet republics, that you see all the resistance to it, whereas the West is just completely cucked. You know, Sweden, the UK, and all of these other countries, maybe with an exception, countries like Italy and Spain are a little bit more resistant, but still not really doing very much.
Yeah, I think it has to do with communism, because communism, communist countries, and East Germany was a communist country, were more traditional than Western capitalist countries. As strange as it sounds, but it's true. Like they had a healthy sense of morality in communist countries, which was completely destroyed in the West. So I would say, in general, they were anti-homosexual, like anti-immigrant, and basically the upholding of national values and national traditions. For example, in Berlin, in East Berlin, which was the capital of the German Democratic Republic, like it was the communist regime which re-erected the statue of Frederick the Great in the center of the city, because they themselves viewed themselves as the successor to Prussia, to some extent, I would say, because the German Democratic Republic upheld Prussian values, which is very evident in the field gray uniforms that they adopted, as opposed to the American-style uniforms that the West German army adopted. And they also kept the goose steps, like when the soldiers were marching in front, like down the streets in East Berlin, in front of various monuments, like was still the Prussian goose steps that they used. But in the West, it was already abolished, because it's too Prussian, too fascist, it's too nationalist. But the East Germans never cared about it. They kept all these traditions. And I would say the same was true in the Soviet Union and the other communist countries of the Eastern Bloc, that they basically kept more traditions intact, and they were not poisoned by, I would say, the American pop culture that basically flooded Western Europe, including Western Germany, and the ideals of liberalism, because all the communist countries were, that I would say, completely opposed to any kind of liberal ideology. But the West swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, and basically became completely liberalized, and therefore diseased, and therefore more susceptible to the invaders. And I would say now, Eastern Europe and Central Europe, including East Germany, they still have a different mentality than West Germans, because of their communist past, or because of the fact that they grew up in a society that was more traditional than Western Germany.
Do you think also that economics plays a role? Because in the West, you know, people are obsessed with money, and the GDP and that's like the number one priority for almost any Western country, is just like making as much money as possible, and the businesses as successful as possible. It seems like they don't prioritize anything else. And you can bring in millions of these migrants and refugees, and the government will just say, well, the GDP is going up. Even though the companies that are actually getting the money are, they have no allegiance to any of these European countries. It's just kind of like the money's good, the GDP, the money is all going to these globalized corporations and multinationals that not really that employ foreign workers and outsourcing and whatnot. Whereas in Eastern Europe, you have these the people in these countries maybe were not brought up in such a way that that money and all of this kind of, like you said, American pop culture, but not just like the social liberalism, but the actual you know, the actual the materialism, not materialism in the philosophical sense, but just in the consumerist sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's true because I don't know, just living here in Russia, and I know I've met a lot of Russians. I know a lot of Russians, and in my opinion, to be honest, to me they seem equally materialist than any Westerner. Like also, I mean, people here are also interested. They want to watch all the Hollywood movies now. They want to go to all the clubs at the weekend. They want to go to all the cool bars, new restaurants. Want to own like iPhone 7 as soon as it comes out. On all the gadgets, everything else, the clothes. Sure. I mean, I don't know. To be honest, I see no difference. And it's the same in East Germany. Like I would say the average East German guy is the same as the average West German guy now. I mean, in the sense that they both want things, more and more things. Because, I mean, when the end of the GDR was like almost 30 years ago. So it's like almost like it's more than a generation ago. So, I mean, most young people that live in East Germany now, they weren't even born in the GDR. So, but they still have this mentality because I guess they inherited it from their parents, which is not necessarily anti-materialist, but in my opinion, just more traditional and with still a higher moral standard than in the West, because these were the kind of values that were inculcated in the German Democratic Republic, but which were completely lost in the Federal Republic of Germany. Like such, I think the same is true in Russia. I mean, you can talk to any Russian, and they will tell you that in the Soviet Union, you didn't have all this like liberal decadence that you even have now in Russia, or even more so in the West. You know, it's like gay parades, unthinkable in the Soviet Union. Well, still unthinkable in Russia today because people are just horrified at the thought. From them is a completely alien concept. It's like, what the hell is this? What is this? Gay parades? What for? What's the point? You know, it's like, but in the West, if you say something like this, you're like, oh, well, you're a Nazi, fascist, racist, homophobe, etc. Because you have to accept that they should like dance around half naked on a street and stroke each other's dicks, you know, while they stand next to on the side of the street and watch it. But Russians don't want this in their country. It's like, why would they want this? What's it? I mean, and that's healthy. It's just normal. It's just like a normal, healthy attitude. So it's in the West that is completely perverted. And the West is the deviant. And I would just say Russians are normal, or Central Europeans or Eastern Europeans, they're just normal, healthy attitudes. They're not extreme, just normal. It's the West that's extreme.
It's really obnoxious when they start doing these things to other non-whites, especially in the Asian countries. I know every white label's favorite non-white country is Japan, and they will assume history by saying, well, there's a big gay community in Japan as there is in America, when really they're just deliberately and distorting facts and making this white appropriation of they're trying to spread their decadence around the globe as if things are universal and everybody can be whitewashed to be white liberals or white decadent things. That's not true. As you just said, Russian people are actually healthy, normative, and it's like white Americans that are so, you know, depraved. And it's sad because it's like those who knew on the alt-right in America are on the healthy side. It's just that we really have a hostile elite that is distorting the institutions and just changing things around. It's really a one-sided biased story.
No, completely. I completely agree. Like, I mean, I lived in America for many years, and I've been to lots of bars in America and started lots of discussions in America. And I was actually kicked out of several bars because of things I said, politically incorrect things. But saying the same things in Russia, you never get kicked out. Like half the bar blocks you, like joins you and cheers with you. It's like, yes, you're right. It's great. And pretty much like, just talking about freedom of speech. So in my opinion,
were they like hipster bars or working class bars?
Well, in the United States, so it's like, I would say working class bars, not so bad. Yeah, I would say it's like most of the bars I got kicked out. I was in New Orleans because I went to university there. but mostly like white bars, or like with a few like token blacks in the bar, but not so many. Yeah, so I would say hipster bars probably, obviously. Yes, but like working class, I used to go to working class bars in like Pittsburgh and I don't know, some small towns in Texas or even Louisiana, like Napoleonville. And of course, it's a completely different story there. Yeah, but I would say like But the difference with Russia is that in Russia there is no such differentiation between, like, I would say, hipster bars and working class bars, because you can go to any bar and you pretty much can say anything you want, meaning things that are completely taboo in the West, and people will accept them. Like, they wouldn't even turn around if they hear you say something, I don't know, pertaining to race or homosexuality or something Westerners would find disagreeable. Most Russians would actually agree, and even if they disagreed, they wouldn't be so vocal about it like in the West.
You've advocated an alliance between Moscow, Berlin, Jerusalem, this Moscow, Berlin, Jerusalem axis against American influence and Islam. How do you take into account this sort of alliance between America and Israel, and how would that come into fruition?
Yeah, that was a long time ago when I advocated that. That was in 2006, I believe, at the second Moscow conference. So I don't really, I wouldn't say I don't really subscribe to everything that I wrote back then anymore. But my main idea was that basically the West, meaning Europeans, the White West, should work together with Israel, because in my opinion, Israel is an integral part of the West, because it was founded basically by, I would say, mostly Ashkenazi Jews. As a European outpost almost, and I don't see why Israel should be given up to the Muslims. It should be defended out of principle, just because, I would say, only because the majority of Muslims want us basically to abandon Israel and want to destroy Israel. That's just one more reason to defend it at all costs. Because otherwise, it's just appeasement. Like, why should we do what basically the Muslims demand? And, well, working together with Moscow, of course, because Moscow is a very influential player, very influential global player. And, yeah, well, I would say against America was back then when I had a more negative view of America, which now has changed with Trump.
Because of Trump.
I think America can be redeemed if Trump plays his cards right, and maybe if he gets reelected, it's even better. So I'm more optimistic about America now, because if Trump is successful, you could have sort of like a sea change in mentality in the United States, which moves away from political correctness to sort of like become healthier again and more normal. So we'll see. Yeah, so because then my ideal would be like an alliance. The best alliance, in my opinion, would be White America and Russia against China, because I think China is an even bigger threat. So you have China and Islam, which both work against white interests. And you have the two most powerful white countries, which is still the United States, and Russia working together to basically contain this these two threats together. Because now they're still working against each other in Syria, which is foolish, but while they should be collaborating, and of course Israel should be included. So I can't relate to some people on the right who are hysterical about Israel, who believe that was this the tail that whacked the dog. So I don't know. It's like, Zionism makes perfect sense, because the Jews have a right to their homeland. They built the homeland in the desert. They built all the cities. They built the infrastructure. Now there they are. And it's a tiny, tiny strip of land. The Muslims are hysterical also about it. They want the Jews gone, but the Muslims have a lot of territory. Jordan doesn't want the Palestinians, even though technically Palestinians are Jordanians. Why don't they accept the Palestinians? A lot of Jews were kicked out of Muslim countries after Israel's war of independence, or during Israel's war of independence, and Israel took all of them. So why can't the Muslim countries take all the Muslims, the so-called Palestinian, displaced Palestinians? Because they don't want them. They want to keep the Palestinians in Israel as pawns against the Zionist state. So I don't know. I think Israel is a part of the West, like America, Europe, and Russia. It should stick together.
You've spent time in Israel, and if you look at a lot of the beauty pageants in Israel, you see all these young blonde women of a Germanic or Slavic ancestry. Based on your observations in Israel, are there a lot of women like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say a lot, but they exist. I don't know. I couldn't give you a percentage. Maybe 20%, 25%, just a rough guess. But, I mean, you do see them, especially in big cities like, I mean, Tel Aviv, you see quite a lot of them. Jerusalem, I've seen them. I mean, yeah, you see them all over Israel. But Israel is a multi-ethnic, it's a multi-racial state. So you also see black Jews, Ethiopian Jews, you have the Arab Jews, you have white Jews, Eastern European Jews. So it is a melting pot, really, Israel. And this is also why I don't understand why, when a lot of people on the right say, they say, oh, Israel Israelis are hypocritical. They support mass immigration of non-Europeans into Europe, but they don't want mass immigration into Israel. Like, Israelis want to keep Israel pure, but Europe, they basically want to destroy its homogeneity. But it's completely not true, in my opinion, because Israel is already multiracial, multi-ethnic. It's not pure at all. And and at the same time, these right-wing guys, they say, okay, Jews, they support, like, I don't know, decadence, like gay parades in the West, in Europe. But at the same time, they support them in Israel as well, because now, like, the top one gay destination in the world is Tel Aviv, and they have gay parades in Tel Aviv. They have gay parades in Israel. So how does that work? I don't know.
Do you think a lot of these women who are of Germanic and Slavic ancestry, like blonde hair, blue eyes, within Israel, should we try to incorporate them into a European culture and encourage them to move to Europe and the United States as a way to sort of increase our numbers?
No, I don't think it's necessary why they can stay in Israel if they want to stay in Israel, because they can procreate there and defend Israel with their European genes, because most likely Ashkenazi Jews, which is basically a member of I consider Ashkenazi Jews a member of the European family. So if they want to stay in Israel, they can stay in Israel. If they want to move to Europe, I would say they're welcome, because they're Europeans.
Robert's in love with this actress named Alicia Silverstone. Miss Silverstone is of Jewish descent and Scottish and Irish. We are looking at this before. She was in cheesy movies in the 80s called The Crush and Clueless. And she looks Nordic and could pass as that blonde Aryan that these white nationalist types would like, but unfortunately her Jewish background does not add up to that. And so websites like Stormfront will be all sad and say, well, she's not the Nordic woman, she's actually Jewish, oh boo-hoo, you know, stuff like that. And however, Robert, being influenced from my own philosophy of Asian Aryanism, made up this jokey term called Israeli Aryanism, which he believes that you could still have Nordic or blonde-looking Jewish women, but they don't have to have allegiance to Judaism, right? It just happens to be a mix between the blonde look of the European and of the Jewish. And Robert seems to really love that aesthetic, but in no way do I advocate it.
Do you think she could pass for a German?
Well, Alicia Silverstone? Yeah, I would say yes.
No, I disavow.
Yeah, I disavow too.
You can. That's all you, Robert. If you
I
want
know
to,
it's all Robert. And he's pretending.
If you
want
to advocate that stuff, then you can deal with majority rights. Writing an article about
exactly.
That, but
exactly. I'm not gonna be the dummy supporting that. So.
Well, Bill Eater, you have your whole
exactly
project.
I have my own project. Okay.
Well, Pillater's Asian Aryanism is interesting, is it kind of does exist in places like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, where you see a hybrid of a Russian and Mongol culture. Constantine, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, I lived in Uzbekistan for a year. I was working there 10 years ago in Tashkent. And actually, to be honest, I didn't see a lot of hybrids. Yeah, like you have a minority Russian population in Uzbekistan, and you have a majority Uzbek population. You have quite a few Koreans that live in Uzbekistan, but they came, I suppose, like hundreds of years ago during Tsarist time. So they've been completely integrated, incorporated, speak fluent Russian, speak fluent Uzbek, etc. So yeah, I mean, in Russia itself, like, I'm not sure what you mean by hybrids. Like, in Russia, you could say, like, you have hybrids, because in
maybe
Russia,
in Siberia is
Well, you have lots of ethnicities in Russia, lots of different ethnicities, because Russia is a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious country. So you see, I would say you could see a lot of Russians. I would say they could have some admixture. I could be Georgian, could be Tatar, could be Mongol, could be, I don't know, could be Armenian, etc. So I mean, I would say like not a lot, but. But quite a few Russians could be considered "quote unquote" hybrids. That's where you have different admixtures, simply because of the fact that Russia has always been a multi-ethnic state and never really homogeneous state because it was an empire.
What are your thoughts on secular Arab nationalism as a bulwark against Wahhabism?
Yeah, I support it. Yes, like I thought Saddam was a good leader, and it was a big mistake of the West, and especially the United States, to overthrow Saddam, because in my opinion, the Arabs, they basically need strong leaders like Saddam that can hold the different factions and again ethnicities, peoples together, and. If you remove these leaders like Saddam and Gaddafi, then everything falls apart and you have civil war, basically. And then you have Islamists fighting against non-Islamists, you have the Sunnis against the Shiites, etc. So basically you need secular nationalism in the Arab world just to force these people to live together in a civilized manner. And I don't understand why the U.S. doesn't see that. Or maybe the U.S. does see it, and they have their own agenda, which is what I think, because they can't be that stupid, you know, to not be able to see that simply, like, American-style democracy doesn't work in the Arab world.
How do you square that with support for Israel, though? Because Israel is typically the one that pushes the U.S. to act in those countries. You know, they agitated for, you know, overthrowing Saddam for many years. That, you know, the lobbies in the U.S. and they, you know, advocate for you know, overthrowing Assad in Syria and Libya. You know, they agitated for that also. You know, so how do you square that with Israel, which is often kind of goading the U.S. to get involved in these conflicts, usually on a side which is you know, counterintuitive to what our interests should be.
Yeah, for me it's a complete mystery, to be honest. Just like the U.S. can't possibly benefit from overthrowing leaders like Saddam, Assad, or Gaddafi, Israel can't benefit from it either. Like, the only reason I can see why Israel is pushing for it is because most of these leaders are vitriolically anti-Israel. Maybe some Israeli leaders are paranoid that they might stage some kind of massive terrorist attack, maybe with poison gas in Israel. That's why they want to see them gone. Which, in my opinion, is quite irrational, because most of these leaders, I mean, might be brutal like Saddam, but they're not stupid, because I don't think they would ever think of really attacking Israel officially, because they get wiped out, not just by Israel, but by the United States the next day. So, yeah, I don't really understand it. I think it's just a misguided sense of, I know, that their own importance, when at the same time they don't see, just like the U.S. doesn't see, or the West doesn't see, I mean, the West overall doesn't see, that when you remove these strong leaders, you create chaos, and you bring Islamists to the foreground that hate Israel even more and hate the West even more. Because I think to the Islamists, I would say, don't they call the United States is a great Satan and Israel is little Satan? So, I mean, they create more dangers to themselves than when these people are in power. So yeah, I don't know. It's weird. Yeah, I agree. So I think it's just paranoia. Like, Netanyahu is paranoid. A lot of Israeli leaders are paranoid, but it's misguided.
And even if you go back to the Gulf War, I mean, a lot of the funding for Wahhabism and the Islamization of Europe, the giant mosque, is coming from the Gulf states. I mean, I personally think we should have just let Saddam Hussein invade Kuwait and all those Gulf states.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, yeah, you can go to places like India. I just came back from India, and in India, they build a lot of mosques now, and they're all funded by Saudi Arabia. I mean, it says it openly sometimes, like they have signs at a mosque, like funded, built by state of Saudi Arabia. Same in Germany, France, Netherlands, all, I mean, not all, but a lot of the mosques are paid for by the Saudi government. So, yeah, the Saudi government is a major enemy of the West, including the United States. But the United States is in bed with Saudi Arabia because business ties, etc., and so on. So they can't really do anything about Saudi Arabia, which is a big problem. Yeah, and I agree with you. They should have let Saddam invade Kuwait, take it over, and then maybe even continue to the other ones.
If you look at architecture, I know it's kind of fashionable to hate Brutalism. You're actually a big fan of Brutalism, and Rabbit and I are interested in it ourselves as well. Can you talk about your interest in a Brutalist architecture?
Yeah, well, just very simple. I just find it aesthetically pleasing. Again, because of its monumental character, like it pleases my imperial aesthetic sensibilities, I would say. Because for me, it's also very Faustian in character, Brutalism, just because of the sheer size and the impact it makes on the viewer. And I have to agree with the German propaganda minister Goebbels, who also said in World War II, when the German cities were obliterated, like the beautiful old buildings were destroyed. But Goebbels said, you know, it's not all bad that they're destroying our cities, because it gives us a reason to build something new. So we don't have to be like the bad guys and destroy all these buildings ourselves, because like the enemy is already doing it for us, and we can build something grand, something monumental, instead of the old stuff that is there right now. So I feel the same about Brutalism. So I'm not against, of course, old beautiful architecture. I wouldn't advocate like the demolition of like an ancient city, ancient town, old town, just to build Brutalist architecture there. But if you already have the space, why not build something else and make the cityscape more eclectic? Because you can look at Paris, like Haussmann's Paris. Because Haussmann, like he in the 19th century, he pretty much destroyed, I'm not sure, like 20% of the old town of Paris, beautiful medieval streets, etc., and built these uniform houses, which are now characteristic of Paris. When you think of Paris, you think of Haussmann's Paris. And you had Le Corbusier, who also wanted to destroy like a large part of the Marais. I think the Marais district in Paris, he wanted to raise to the ground and build these monumental skyscrapers, brutalist skyscrapers with parks around it. Three-tier parks, I think, with underground parking, grass, playgrounds, swimming pools, artificial lakes and everything, where people have open spaces, expanses of open space, major roads, arteries, beautiful office towers. Instead, you have it didn't come into fruition, Corbusier's plan. Instead, of you still have the old streets in Paris. I know, I would have preferred Corbusier's vision to what we have in Paris now, even though it's very beautiful what you have in Paris now. So I think, yeah, we can keep some old stuff, but we shouldn't just protect the old stuff just because it's old. Sometimes, I mean, you need the space, and it's necessary to put something new, there to make it more interesting.
I can't really comment on Paris because I've never been there. I mean, it does look magical from films and photographs, but I have been to London, and I found the financial district area a little bit bland. But what I do like about London is the sort of contrast between a lot of the historic architecture that was built in the 17th to 19th century. A lot of the old Victorian train stations, but I also like a lot of the brutalist skyscrapers. There's the famous one by the architect Goldfinger, and then I also really like the BT Tower and the Center Point Glass Brutalist Tower, which is on the eastern end of the West End, if you're familiar with those buildings.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them. I've been a lot of many times. Yeah, I'm also a big fan. I completely agree with you. And the same is true in Berlin, by the way, because it was almost completely destroyed. You have some old buildings left, but you have a lot of new buildings, including brutalist ones. And that makes the cityscape, in my opinion, more interesting than uniform Paris. And yeah, I'm also a big fan, I would say, of Bauhaus architecture, which is related to brutalist architecture, I would say. And I say the prime example, I don't know if you're familiar with Bauhaus, you know, the architectural movement Bauhaus. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Because in like Tel Aviv is basically a Bauhaus city, and it's also UNESCO World Heritage Site. They call it the White City because you have all these beautiful white Bauhaus buildings in Tel Aviv. They were all built by, I would say, by Jews that basically ran away from Nazi Germany because Bauhaus started in Germany in the 1920s. The Nazis didn't like it, so they banned it. So all the Bauhaus architects and designers, well, not all of them, but a lot of them were Jewish and basically emigrated to Palestine and then built the city of Tel Aviv in Bauhaus style.
Are you a fan of the mid-century space age aesthetic? I know Rabbit's a big fan of that.
You mean like 1950s?
Mid-century modern, yeah.
Yeah.
Like mid-century modern.
Yeah, like atomic space age stuff. Like
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, like
the, yeah, you, well, you know, like 50s and 60s, like American modern architecture. You see, or you even saw some of it, a lot of it in the Western Europe at that time too.
I know Denmark is famous for that design. Well, there's a famous Danish architect and designer, Arne Jacobsen, and there. I mean, my grandparents owned a Danish, a Scandinavian import store. My grandfather was from Denmark, so growing up, like, we had a lot of that mid-century Danish furniture. But there's a lot of that in Europe as well.
Yeah, I think it's aesthetically quite pleasing. I like it. You see a lot of that in Germany too. A lot of the buildings that were built, I would say, after the war, because again, a lot of it was destroyed, so they had to build sometimes very quickly something new in the villages, towns, and cities. And they used a lot of that aesthetic, which you can still see, which is hated a lot by a lot of people today. I don't see why. I like it. Most of it, some I don't like. So it depends what it looks like exactly, or which buildings exactly we're talking about.
Do you like Art Deco, like the Chrysler Building and Empire State Building?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Art Deco. Yes, and Art Nouveau as well. Yes, so Chrysler Building is my favorite building in Manhattan. I've always liked the Chrysler Building. Yeah, I also like Art Nouveau, which is, like I said, the precursor of Art Deco. But yeah, it's like I've been to Helsinki, and Helsinki is almost exclusively built in the Art Nouveau style. Almost the whole city. It's quite impressive, and. Yeah, and in Moscow, you have a lot of Orthodox churches. And there's one church which was built in, I think, 1911 or 1912, I'm not sure, which is completely built in the Art Nouveau style inside and some of the pictures outside, which is completely unique because I've never seen anything like it in all of Russia. Yeah, but the Chrysler Building is very impressive, yeah, especially the gargoyles sticking out. Yeah, I totally dig.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite buildings in America. And we touched upon the Le Corbusier's plan for a central Paris. I think destroying the historic core of Paris would have been a disaster, but it's sort of fashionable to hate Le Corbusier. I think there is a lot of great inspiration from that plan for revitalizing our inner, kind of decaying inner ring suburbs. And especially, I mean, I'm coming at it from American cities. We have these decaying areas in American cities, like, and just creating these areas of these kind of glass brutalist skyscrapers, these self-contained garden cities with lakes and parks, and then a lot of the infrastructure and highways and subways and shopping malls could be put underground. I mean, I'd like to see that in those decaying inner ring suburbs. And even if in L.A., there's a development called Park La Brea, which is sort of based on Le Corbusier's style. I know some people will say that the public housing projects were a disaster, and they'll try to compare it to that. But those were geared more to the sort of like lowest in the low end of society. I'm talking about like building housing for the middle class en masse in the inner ring suburbs based on Le Corbusier's plan.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good idea. I completely agree with you. I've also been to Chandigarh. I don't know if you're familiar. Have you heard of Chandigarh? It's a city in India. And have you heard of this city, Chandigarh?
Oh, is it the one that's famous for brutalism?
No, it was completely, it was almost the entire city. It was an artificial city. It was built after India's independence. As basically, it's like obviously you have Astana in Kazakhstan or Brasilia in Brazil. These artificial capitals, like, that are built from scratch. And Chandigarh is the same. It was built from scratch, and they hired Le Corbusier to design the whole city. And I've been there, so the whole city was designed by Corbusier. All the government buildings, all the streets, the patterns, and everything. And it's very fascinating, like, the government district in Chandigarh, and it's very brutal. It's all concrete. And one of the government buildings is a gigantic swastika, which is acceptable in India, of course, because of Hinduism. Yes, so I have a photograph of me standing next to the swastika. It's a very famous Corbusier building in Chandigarh. Very nice, beautiful. If you ever get to India, you have to go. You have to visit Chandigarh. So, yeah, because it's just very orderly, very straight, very linear. It's like, yeah, it's just beautiful.
Rabbit, weren't you saying something similar about that idea for revitalizing like decaying suburbs, building like these utopian societies with lakes and self-contained housing?
Well, I don't know if I would call it utopian, but I think that when you see these little suburban communities and what I see, like, a lot of missed potential, because they have the potential to be these self-sustaining communities, which would have, everything that you would need. But instead, they're just like these gated communities with just houses and, like, maybe like a fitness center or something like that. But I would like to see them be build more of them that are actually, like, almost like fully self-contained, you know, with the with an interior, school and a number of different businesses and shops and cafes, kind of like when you go to Las Vegas and you go into those hotels like the Venetian. You know, they have their own inside of it. They have their own lines of with shops. And
what's interesting about Las Vegas is we were there. We took a trip there together. And the way the city functions is you have the people of the city live in this, like, horrible suburban sprawl, but then they have these casinos just as a tourist attraction, and they're used for gambling. But why don't you sort of incorporate those ideas as models of urbanism as a self-contained city? It's just kind of interesting how the city functions.
I've been to the Venetian. It's very interesting because they have the gondolas inside and the fake St. Mark's Square and everything with artificial sky.
Right.
It's almost surreal, I think.
I was looking at those photographs you took of India, and they actually do remind me of the geography around Nevada.
Well, it's very similar because you have a lot of... I went to Maharashtra a couple of weeks ago, which is a state where Bombay is located. And I was just traveling around different cities when hiking in the mountains there. Yeah, and it looks very similar, I agree. We're basically just traveling in the footsteps of Shivaji, the great Hindu king. So we went to a lot of the forts that are forts in the mountains that are associated with Shivaji. Went to a lot of Hindu temples and old towns, market towns, some big cities, some museums. So yeah, it was a very cultural trip, but also a lot of nature and a lot of spicy food.
One other architect I like is John C. Portman. I sent you a picture of his work. I mean, I consider him to be one of the greatest post-war architects. And his style is kind of, it's neo-brutalist, but it's also more glitzy. Like, you have the kind of concrete slabs of brutalism, but with a lot of light fixtures and gold details and these massive atriums. But what's interesting about Portman is he said that his greatest inspiration in architecture was from the Champs-Élysées in Paris and Tivoli in Denmark. And that's not something you'd kind of associate with that kind of futurist, neo-brutalist aesthetic. Are you familiar with Portman's work?
You basically all... I've seen it online. I've seen pictures online. I've never seen the building with my own eyes. But from what I've seen, like, well, I'm just looking at this picture. It's like some kind of structure that he built with sort of like tentacles sticking out. Almost looks like something out of Call of Cthulhu. Very almost Lovecraftian, I would say, which is also interesting. So, and to be honest, I don't see the connection to the Champs-Élysées myself. So
no, I was saying I don't really see it, but in an interview, that's what he said. He was actually asked about his greatest inspiration. I think it's kind of interesting that that's the place he chose.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like the aesthetics. It's interesting. It's different, and it's not boring like a lot of the new buildings that we have, because they all look very uniform. They all look the same, so it's different, which is already a good thing, but different in a positive way. And yeah, I like it. I think it's called the tulip. Yes, that flowery kind of structure, but looks more like Cthulhu, one of the great old ones, which I find interesting. Yes.
What do you think about the proposals for the Palace of the Soviets, which was, it was during World War II, but it never came into fruition because of the war?
Where? Which one? Which palace?
You mean the one in Moscow.
Ah, well, actually, I live right next door to it.
No, I'm not. I'm saying the hypothetical.
I know, but I live right next door to where the palace was supposed to be built. It's near metro station Kropotkinskaya. It's across the river from the building where I live. And now you have the Cathedral of Christ the Savior there. Because I'm sure you know the history, because originally you had the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, like the biggest cathedral, in the biggest Orthodox cathedral in Russia. The Bolsheviks didn't like it. They said, okay, well, it's Orthodox, it's religious, so we've got to get rid of it. So their idea was, like you said, they wanted to build this massive palace of the Soviets with a statue of Lenin on top, and just the statue of Lenin would have been the size of the Statue of Liberty, so just like the dimensions were just ridiculously massive, like it was supposed to be huge. And so they blew up the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. Then they wanted to build the Palace of the Soviets. They even named the metro station Palace of the Soviets already, but then they found out that the ground was unstable, so it wasn't really feasible to build such a massive structure there. So instead, they just had a swimming pool till the end of the Soviet Union on that space.
What's ironic about that is it does remind me a lot of those Italian futurist renderings for cities.
The Palace of the Soviets, you mean the palace, the structure, Palace of the structure itself?
Renderings remind me of the Italian futurist renderings for their plans for cities in Italy.
Yeah, but you also have the Russian futurists at the time, and they were also influenced by the Italian futurists. So it's like you have the Mayakovsky, the Russian poet, you had a lot of like Russian futurists, artists, and I think that's where it came from, like Russian futurism. And it's just like very imperial in its design and neo-Gothic, but at the same time you have a lot of Roman classical elements and a lot of futurist elements, and they already incorporated like airplanes flying around it, etc. Yeah, you should look at the pictures online, Palace of the Soviets. Would have been a fascinating structure. Unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Are you a fan of those 70s Soviet futurist illustrations?
Yeah, who isn't? Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, very quaint, a bit outdated, but very inspirational, I would say. It's still inspirational today, because it's just full of optimism about what the future can be, especially related to space travel and space colonization, which I consider very important. The Soviets consider it important, but for some reason, people today don't find so important anymore. I don't know why.
There's a place in Moscow called the Novy Arbat Street, and I was looking at photographs of it. It does have a kind of a cyberpunk aesthetic. What do you think about that?
Yeah. What do you mean by I know what you mean by cyberpunk. Like, but what makes you think that Novy Arbat has a cyberpunk aesthetic? In what sense?
Very kind of the dark and the lighting patterns.
Yeah, because what happened was, yeah, like, actually you have two parallel streets. You have Old Arbat and Novy Arbat, and Old Arbat is a pedestrian street, like with a lot of buildings from the 19th century and early 20th century, some of them from the 18th century. So you have a lot of like nice old architecture, but like with street artists, cafes and everything. And like parallel to this, the Soviets basically razed a lot of the old buildings and built this the huge thoroughfare, which they called Novy Arbat, with gigantic buildings in the shape of open books, like several on each side of the street, and one gigantic sort of like globe, which was originally, I think, an Aeroflot advertisement. And but of course there were not as many neon lights in the Soviet Union. Today in Russia, it's like full of neon lights, of course. You have lots of bars on the street now, lots of restaurants, etc., cinemas. Yeah, I would say it could be in the movie Blade Runner almost. And yeah, I like the aesthetic just because of the contrast, because you can walk from Novi Arbat like down a little side street and you're in Old Arbat, which looks completely different because you have all these beautiful, quaint old 19th century, 18th century buildings there.
So, yeah, Constantine, I wanted to ask you about your poetry. You've got, there's quite a bit of it, you know, floating around out there on the internet. You know, have you ever considered like, putting out a chapbook or anything of poetry? And, if you could give maybe some of your inspiration. So I know you have some of your more well-known poems, I think, are Riders on the Worm and Naked Aryan Woman. Naked Aryan Woman, that's a kind of a contemporary classic in, nationalist circles. So if you could just elaborate on it, do you still write poetry or, what are your plans?
Yeah, I still write a lot. I just haven't posted a lot recently, but I'm planning to post a lot on a new blog that I started. It's already up. You can already read quite a bit on it, but I'm going to add a lot of new stuff to it in the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks, because I've been writing the last 2 years. I've been writing these short stories, or I would say short vignettes, and I want to post them all. And yeah, eventually I want to publish a book maybe with a collection of my writings. So yeah, we'll see. But I still write a lot, and I'm going to update the blog more because I've been a bit lazy, so I've been a bit inactive, so I haven't posted a lot of my new stuff in the last couple of years. But yeah, I want to do that. I want to do that now and basically update my blog on a regular basis so people can read my new things. So I can tell you, it's I can tell you right now if you don't mind. It's ogenocht.blogspot.ru. So it's ogenocht.blogspot.ru. So that's my blog. So I already have a bunch of stuff on it, but I'm going to update it very soon.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Constantine von Hofmeister for being on. It's been an excellent show. Covered a lot of really interesting topics.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And also thanks, Pillator and Rabbit.
Thank you.
Thanks.